The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha, this is Adam Asquith with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College Program.
And this is Don Heacock with the Division of Aquatic Resources.
Welcome to another version of Kauai Kai and Why, where we talk about our island's freshwater and marine ecosystems and try to talk with kupuna and kahuna who are willing to share their manao about how to sustainably manage these resources for future generations. And welcome to, tuning in to listen to our program. Thank you, Dean, for your expert engineering. I want to remind folks that this is a call-in show, but we want to talk about go over a few details for the first 15 or 20 minutes, and then you're encouraged to call in with questions and comments to 826-7771. Folks who heard our last program, remember that we talked with a graduate student from the University of Hawaii, Manoa, named Christina Runyon. Is that right, Don?
That's correct.
We talked about she and her laboratory are studying the coral diseases that are stressing our parietes rice corals here on the island. And one of the goals of studying that is eventually to try to identify environmental stressors that might be causing those diseases. And we are fortunate to have here on island Dr. Carl Berg, who engages in sampling our marine and freshwater ecosystems to help identify some of those environmental stressors. We are fortunate to have Dr. Carl Berg here in the studio with us today. Welcome, Carl. Thank you again for coming in and sharing.
Mahalo. Glad to be here.
Carl, just for our listeners' sake, Adam, Carl was also one of the authors of a U.S. Geological Survey report published in 2001 entitled Survey of Chemical Contaminants in the Hanalei River. And so a lot of the data he'll present today will probably be related or in the right out of that document as well. But let Carl introduce himself.
Yeah, we're going to back up a second. And
one other thing, that black band disease that's affecting some of our coral, it's the genus Montipora, not parietes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's all right.
I misspoke.
Just for the taxonomists out there. Please, Carl, introduce yourself.
So, Carl, what is your background? How did you get here to Kauai and start looking at our marine environment?
I'm a marine biologist. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Connecticut in biology. I have a master's degree in marine science from the University of the Pacific and a doctorate degree from the University of Hawaii in zoology, which is the study of animals, but my specialty is studying the animals in the marine environment. And then after that, I was a university professor teaching marine biology, marine ecology, animal behavior classes in New York City. I finished up at 5 years and went to the Marine Biological Laboratory, one of the premier marine biology labs in the nation, or actually in the world, and was a scientist there for 15 years with university affiliations at Harvard University and Columbia University. I then left and went to the state of Florida and was in charge of their marine research on coral reef lobsters and conch, a snail that's down in the Florida Keys. But at that time, I got disillusioned with living on the mainland and decided to move back to Hawaii because I fell in love with it when I was doing my graduate work here. And after checking all the different islands, I decided I really wanted to live on the north shore of Kauai because it was so beautiful, so clean, so wonderful. And when I got here, after building my own home, I took a job with the Department of Health, and that neat job was environmental scientist, and I went out and studied water quality in the streams and in the ocean. And what I discovered in that was that our streams were polluted with lots of nutrients, with a lot of mud, and with bacteria from warm-blooded animals. I worked with them from 1991 to 1993, and then took off and traveled a bit and came back and started working as a volunteer and then was chief scientist for the Hanalei Watershed Hui. And that program was to look at the coral reef systems of Hanalei and all of the inputs coming from land and how terrestrial inputs shape the coral reef ecology. So we have the heavy waves like we're having right now and the ocean currents, but we also have terrestrial inputs. So for about 5 years, I worked on that aspect, and we brought in scientists from all over the nation to look at their specific aspects. I was general coordinator looking at the overall ecology, both of the land and the ocean, but we brought the experts in to do that. And for this work, we got a certificate of recognition from the U.S. Coral Reef Task Force for all our work on the coral reefs, from the EPA Environmental Achievement Award because it was such a broad-spread program. The State DLNR gave us the Hawaii Living Reef Award. And since that time, I've continued not working with Hanalei Watershed Hui for the past, I don't know, 6-7 years, but working with Surfrider and spending more time looking at how we can clean up the rivers and streams and being more specific on how much nutrients are coming from the different places, how much bacteria, and overall trying to make this a more sustainable ecosystem. And I think most of my work, but not all of it, has been done in Hanalei. And I think we have to understand that Hanalei Bay is an estuary, meaning we have huge amounts of water coming in from the Hanalei River, the three little streams to the west, and then also the little stream coming in from Princeville. So we know there's input coming in there. But the reefs themselves are being shaped by that really high surf that we're having, for example, now, and the terrestrial input. One of the things I've seen over the past 10 years, and the thing that really worries me, is that starfish, corals, marine mammals are dying off all over the world's oceans. And this has been attributed to changes in the overall ocean climate, which is brought on by global climate change. Some of the work I've done is on ocean acidification here in nearshore waters of Hawaii. We have that problem. We have the decrease in oxygen in the oceans. We have the increase of temperature in the ocean. And all of those are putting stress on the marine environment, including the coral reefs. So the outbreak of the black band coral disease was first discovered on Kauai by Dr. Abbey in 2004 when she was working with the greater program that I was in charge of. And since that time, we've seen an increase in the amount of coral disease, and that may be leveling off. And we don't know whether this is a natural cyclic event, maybe a long-term 10 or 20-year cyclic event, or whether it was caused by something just more recently. And so what we're still looking at, are what are the nutrient loads going in from the streams and rivers? What is the sediment load coming in from the streams and rivers? Bacterial load coming in? And putting this on top of all of the mixing and water movement, trying to get an idea whether land-based pollution is having a major effect on the coral reefs. So the quick answer is yes, but how much and from what place, it's hard to decide because some of the places we're seeing coral dying off or sea urchins dying off, these things don't seem to have terrestrial input. Deep water reefs don't have it, but they're still experiencing coral reefs. So coral reefs worldwide are in trouble, and we're part of the worldwide ecosystem.
So let's
well put.
Yeah, so let's frame this this issue in kind of a human medical term. So we have our patient is the coral reef, right? And it's coming in. So we have a health problem, and we've got doctors, environmental doctors like Carl Berg and
Dr. Terry Work and others.
Exactly, who are working really hard to address the ills of our patient. But just like a human patient, if they come in with a problem, so we've identified the problem. What we haven't identified are the stressors that are causing that problem. So if you've got a patient with a particular health problem, and the only thing you can identify is that they don't get enough exercise, and you tell them to go begin exercising, and we fail to identify that the patient is also a three-pack-a-day smoker, right? If we fail to recognize that they've got this other major stressor in their life, we may not be able to solve improve the health of the individual. So that's basically where we're at with regard to health of our reefs. We've identified that we've got this particular bacteria disease going on, but we don't know what the various environmental stressors are that might be leading to them developing this disease. Is that kind of a fair analogy, Carl?
That's a great analogy. And I think the other thing is that the reefs on the South Shore may have the same disease, but they have different stressors hitting them. So all around our islands and in the other islands in Hawaii and throughout the Pacific, we have different kinds of stressors that are hitting them all the time.
Yeah. Carl, well, I know that.
The disease picks up. One of the things that's happening, though, out there is that the cyanobacteria, the bacteria in the oceans, are evolving to the new acidity that they're and new temperature ranges. And bacteria evolve very quickly because their life cycle is maybe in minutes or hours. And so we are seeing bacteria who are more suitable living in, say, this high acidic environment, which have never been there before. And these corals, which may not be particularly more stressed than normal, are now hit with a bacterium that's more virulent, more able to infect them and cause them to be diseased.
Right, or sick
so
in some way.
The environment here may not have changed radically, but the microenvironment has changed. And to follow your analogy, we have the same thing in our guts, that if you a disease can take over your in your intestines and wipe out all the other bacteria, and suddenly you get diarrhea and everything else because you're under stress. One bacteria is causing that whole change.
Just to comment on that, I think you made the comment that different stressors could be causing diseases in different places. The converse is also true. The same stressors could be causing different diseases in different areas. All of those are possibilities. And when it is generally true that organisms, plants and animals, don't get sick unless they're stressed. But they can. Disease is a common occurrence in all animal and plant populations. The question is it at a normal level or is it above that? And this black band disease, according to Dr. Greta Abbey and Chris Runyon, is beyond what is normal.
You know, I want to carry the analogy one step further so that our listening audience can understand why it's so important that we talk about the information we're going to talk about today. Because unlike a human patient who has the capacity to stop smoking to help address their health, the coral reefs do not have that capacity. They rely upon us to change whatever those stressors are that we're causing. And so, and the reason this is important is that it's not Carl, an individual on shore. It's us as an entire community. So in order to change the stressors once we identify them, it's going to take probably new laws, new regulations, government money programs, and over several years. So if we identify the wrong stressors or we don't identify the correct ones at all,
it will delay that process.
It's going to delay that process. So we want to make sure, as kind of environmental physicians like Dr. Berg, that we correctly identify these stressors and we can encourage government to begin implementing changes in our island lifestyles to help improve the health of our reefs. Is that fair enough?
And one of the things that we have been talking about on this island a lot is pesticides. And there is a lot of concern about pesticides getting into the environment and polluting our waters and polluting the animals and the reefs, et cetera. And we know that some of these pesticides are endocrine disruptors and change reproductive things. But the unfortunate thing is we have very little data on pesticide loads in the water and in the streams, et cetera. So taking the seed crop or GMO issue aside, we use a lot of pesticides in our lawns, in our houses. We use it on golf courses. We use it all over the island, all over the world. And so we have gone out over the years and addressed some of this pesticide loads. That's an important thing to look at, but it's just one of the things that are out there. And I think Don mentioned that back in 2001, I was worked with the U.S. Geological Survey and Don Heacock and others to look at all of the metals, the organic compounds, the pesticides that were in the Hanalei watershed. And at that time, we looked at the water coming down the rivers because, again, we thought it was coming from land-based stuff. We looked at what was in the water. We looked at what was in the mud in the river. But then we also looked at what was in oopu and in clams and in the kona crabs to see what was in those. And
That
was it was a large study. It took a number of years to have it peer-reviewed and corrected and compare with all the different studies that have been in the state of Hawaii and elsewhere. But that serves as a framework for what was there back in 2001. So it's really useful to see whether we have had more pesticide use or more hydrocarbon use and more metal use, and has that changed anything over the years.
Just
the one last thing is that what we found way back then was in the Hanalei River waters was there was extremely low levels of everything. And they're below detection limit on most of them, below a serious concern in any of those. But they were present. Some of the things like dieldrin were present at that time. So it's not saying that we have an absolutely pure environment. And a lot of the pollutants that we get in our waters, whether metals, for example, come from the volcanic rock. So lava pouring out of the center of the earth is basically liquid metals that then oxidize, rust, and give us the metals in our soil. In the same way, a lot of these organochemicals or organic acid, which some people are talking about, well, this is the normal breakdown product of our vegetation. That's metals break down by rusting. These plant materials break down into constituents, and one of them is organic acids. And so these are naturally occurring things at naturally occurring amounts in our Hawaiian streams, estuaries, and in the ocean. The big thing with the coral reefs and the ocean is that the ocean dilutes it, moves it around, and lowers the concentration dramatically, because especially when we have big, heavy waves.
You know, just a couple of comments, Carl. When we dieldrin is a really good insecticide to use. The United States and many countries banned it in 1988 because it was recognized as being a POP, a persistent organic pesticide. They also label it as a persistent bioaccumulation and toxic compound. And what happens is it's persistent. I think it was 2005, might have been a little earlier than that, we measured using the National Aquatic Water Quality Assessment Program. We looked at water quality, sediment, and fish tissues out in Na Willy Willy Stream. We found that they had the highest, they had the dubious distinction of being tied for first place as having the highest levels of dieldrin in the country, tied only with the New York Bight, one of the most polluted water bodies in the United States. And one of the things about dieldrin is that if you go out and normally just take water samples or sediment samples, you'll find only minute traces, parts per trillion, or nothing. But because they bioaccumulate, they move up the food chain. An insect might be feeding in the mud on the bottom. It's eaten by a worm. It has 10 times the one part per trillion. Goes right up the food chain to the fish. And the higher the predatory fish, the higher the concentration of dieldrin. And we dieldrin, when you look at it in a broad way, there's EPA has a great website on their, they call it their Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, where they claim that dieldrin, even though it's persistent in our environment, can stress fish to where they are susceptible to disease. And the only way we would find dieldrin in coral is to test their tissues. And I know Greta Abe is actually considering doing that right now. And even if we find nothing, if we do, that's a step. We know we can cross that off the list. It's not that stressor. But we haven't crossed that one off the list yet.
You know, one thing, Don, with the dieldrin and other pesticides, that many of them break down over time.
That's right.
But the other thing, your concept of bioaccumulation, that process takes it out of the ecosystem.
That's right.
So that fish who has eaten all the worms and stuff and has it, well, he swims off and goes away someplace, and so it's no longer in the food chain because the fish eventually dies. And so you have a constant movement of this. But I think the important point that you made is that a lot of this stuff that we find in the muds, in the sediment, are there from the natural soils, or they're there from the agriculture or whatever industry that puts the pesticides there. But so many of them are actually bound up to the soils and are not biologically available. Some are, some aren't. And this science is really difficult because you have one substance, say chromium, you have it there, or let's just say nickel is there, it's not available. It doesn't dissolve, and it doesn't get uptaked through your gut, your skin. I think a good example of that are the coins in our pockets, our quarters, dimes, and nickels. They're 25% nickel. But we don't have a major concern that we're going to absorb it through our skin or anything like that.
It's not biologically active. It can't get into biosystems.
Yeah, I think Carl brings up the important aspect of how complicated the science is, and that we have to understand the background levels before we can begin to identify what a level is that might stress the corals and the reef system. And Carl mentioned the problem that with ocean acidification, right, which is triggered by fairly minor changes in the pH of our oceans, right? But you could go here in Hanalei to Waipa, for example, which we have, and take a soil sample from up Mauka, and you can find the soils themselves can have a pH of 4, and sometimes even less than that, which is very acidic, but naturally very acidic.
Okay? Yeah, the water in the Alakai'i Swamp is about pH 4.
4, yeah, very, very acidic, but that's natural.
Yeah.
Okay? So just because we can find these high levels of, let's say, heavy metals in our native soils doesn't mean that that in and of itself is going to be a stressor to the environment, because that's the background level.
Yeah. Well, I think your comment about the streams up in Waipa or the Hanalei is that it is acidic in part because of the metals, but it's also acidic because there's a lot of organic acids there. Acids are acidic. And those organic acids are the byproduct of leaf breakdown.
Yeah,
now, one of the things that I did with Dr. Delovia from the University in Manoa is to look at how fast the ocean is becoming acidic all around the state of Hawaii. And we got the data from the weekly sampling by the Department of the Health for bacteria, but they measure pH, they measure acidity. And we took it, there was like 450 places, we took it down to 50 places around the islands where we had at least 250 measurements. That's a lot. So we eventually had 25,000 measurements of pH. And what we found was the water at the beaches, water at a little bit above ankle, below the knee, that water there is becoming acidic way faster, as much as 10 times faster, than the water in the ocean out at the reefs. So what's causing that? Well, we did a large-scale statistical analysis, and we don't know what's causing it. What we do know is that water near the beach, which is probably contaminated by groundwater, it's not stream water, we filtered that out, but groundwater coming in probably has organic acids in it, which changes the pH just a little. And, well, how does this change over time? We're having more and more plant growth. We're having more tourists with oils on them. We're having all of this. And another fascinating thing was that the places that were showing the greatest acidification were our most popular beaches, Waikiki Beach, Poipu Beach, Kana'apali, the most popular beaches. So we think there's some sort of human influence here, but we don't know. Now, I have to add that these are extremely minor changes in pH because our scientific meters can measure at great acuity. And we're measuring to 5 decimal spots. But we have lots of measurements, 25,000 measurements. So we think the trend is real. Like the open ocean is becoming more acidic, while our nearshore waters are becoming more acidic faster. And that means the things that live near shore, like coral reefs, like mudflats, like the fishes out there, all of them are having to adapt to this change faster than, see, the open ocean. And when they can't adapt, that's when you have stress, and that's when you have immune response breakdown, and that's when you start having problems.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to suggest that our soils are acidic because of that leaching. But what I was trying to explain is that's the natural background. So just because we have identified acidic soils in our environment doesn't mean we need to run out and try to change the acidity of our soils.
Yeah.
That's the natural background.
Fish can't live in any water in general.
Right.
With a pH lower than 5. So when you get up in the Alakai Swamp and you move downstream, you don't even run into any fish until you get well below the confluence of Haleakala and Halepaʻakai.
Right.
All of a sudden it starts getting buffered by the algae, more sunlight.
Right.
You're not up in the fog swamp anymore.
Yep.
And
so,
et cetera.
So in order to begin to identify stressors in our marine environment that might be coming from the shore, we need to try to understand what's the natural background level of these compounds.
That's right.
That are coming from our island and being deposited into the marine environment. Okay, and that's what we're beginning to get some information on. Is that right, Carl?
That's right. And the state of Hawaii actually has a scientist, a PhD, who has compiled then a Hawaiian Island Soil Metal Background Evaluation Report. And all of this is available off the web. Just go, like I did, and say Hawaii Department of Health Metals, and you'll be able to find all these reports there and download them. And Roger Brewer also has, in March of 2013, a fairly recent, a table of the list of the background metals found in our soils. So if we take a mud sample from the rivers, that mud is from our soils, except when it's not. So I've made a table here, and here are the natural background levels. And one thing, though, when you go out onto the reefs, the soil that's on the reef is composed both part of terrigenous, things from the land, and calcareous stuff, things from the ocean. The breakdown of coral shells, lobster shells, and things like that, the white stuff. So, for example, if you take a sample in the middle of Hanalei River, that's probably 100% terrigenous. But if you go to a Nini reef, and I've done this, and you get the sample and you have it analyzed, you'll find that maybe only 40% of the soil there is from terrigenous, and 60% is from the ocean. So all the levels of metals and pollutants would be much, much lower because it's not from the land. It's from the ocean. But things like selenium is really an ocean-based metal.
That's right.
And so you'll see that in there where you won't see it very much up in the muds.
Our soils are very low in selenium. One thing just to clarify, Carl, and this came up at a East Kauai Soil and Water Conservation District meeting a while back. Someone asked, how could Hanalei River, I don't exactly remember the exact figure, but it was something like 68,000 cubic yards of sediment being discharged during an average year out of the Hanalei River. They said, how is it possible that much mud could run out? Well, it wasn't mud. When stream limnologists talk about sediment in a stream, they're talking mainly about sand, basalt sand, cobble, boulders, gravel. Terrigenous sediment is the stuff that washes off the land into the stream. But the stream itself, when we have really big floods, generates a phenomenal amount of sediment, black basalt sand. Look at the Waimea River. Look at the Waimea Beach. It's all black. That's sediment that's come out of the river.
Yeah, and my friends from the U.S. Geological Survey did come here, and we did look at all of the sources of sediment coming into the Hanalei River, and we did fantastic erosion coefficient models for the entire Hanalei watershed, putting in everything. And then Matt Rosner, who's a hydrologist just here, a hydrologist is someone who is specialized in water movement and stuff, they've looked at this, and we've looked at what historically, over the past thousands of years, has been coming down. And your figure, Don, was pretty close. It's 60,000 tons of sediment that comes down in the rivers when we measured it back in 2006.
A ton is probably a cubic yard.
And so that's a total for the course of 1 year. And that was taken way up above all of the diversions, above human influence things like that. That was what was coming from the upper watershed. And that includes three really big spikes where you had 14,000 tons in one rainfall, and then all the days where you got very little. Now, so the past 2 years I've been studying the water in the Hanalei River, and one of the things we measure is how turbid it is, how much you can see the light pass through. But we've done a couple of hundred tests where we also weigh the sediment. So I have
let it settle out and then weigh.
Then I can do the calibration. I can say, well, if you have a turbidity of 4, you have 4.1 grams of turbidity.
And
of topsoil and stuff. That stuff is coming from washing down from the surface, but it's also the stream banks that are eroding. And then as the water rushes down the river, it stirs up, it digs in the bottom. It makes it deeper. So you have resuspension of the bottom. And you put all of that together, plus you get what's coming out of the taro fields, that any kind of drainage system, irrigation system. You put that all together, and that's your total load coming out. But it's important to realize that the upper watershed is contributing most all of this stuff. And you ask, where is it coming from? Well, just look back there. You'll see those big brown scars where these landslides have occurred. And that comes down, and eventually it washes in. Wherever pigs churn up the soil, that eventually washes in. And stream banks and stream beds and everything put that together.
So a reminder to our listeners, this is KKCR, the Kauai Kai and Why program. We have with us today in the studio Dr. Carl Berg, and we're talking about sediment that comes off our island and enters our marine waters, and what is contained in those sediments that might be stressors on our marine environments, causing things like our coral diseases. So in the first half hour, we've been trying to talk about what the natural process is and what some of those natural components might be. Because if we do not understand what the natural background is, we cannot identify an elevated portion of that that might be the stressor. So Carl and Don were just talking about sediment coming out of Hanalei. It's washing down from the maoka portion of our watersheds and is deposited in the near shore marine environment. We can then begin to ask the question, are there compounds in that sediment that might be stressing our coral reefs? We're going to hold the answer to that question while we take a call.
Go ahead, caller.
Go ahead, caller.
I may be able to give you one of the compounds. Over the last month, Honolulu River has had atrazine in it on repeated tests. So not only do you have the particulate matter that's transported into the ocean, but you have the chemical components also.
And I'm sorry, we punched your button a little bit late. So you said you've been doing some sampling also, is that right?
Yeah, I've been in Honolulu River on three occasions has tested positive for atrazine.
For atrazine, fantastic. And so that, in contrast to what we're going to talk about with regard to heavy metals that are components of the sediment, atrazine is not something that would wash in from our Mauka upper watersheds.
No, and I heard Dr. Bird talking about the concentrations that are necessary for toxicity, but as more research is going on, there's papers coming out that are showing that even in humans, that in parts per trillion, you have significant toxicity. So for smaller creatures, parts per trillion is certainly enough with pesticides to create some issues to kill, throw off the imbalance. And I think when you throw off the balance of the ecosystem, that's when you get opportunistic infections. And the cyanobacteria may be an opportunistic infection based on their natural biologic flora being compromised.
Yes, and we appreciate you pointing that out. With regard to pesticides, in some instances, there are no known safe levels that have been identified. And so, and that's with regard to human toxicity. And you're absolutely right. At very, very small concentrations, they may be enough to stress some of the marine organisms and make them susceptible to disease.
The literature is pretty extant on atrazine's both a chronic and subchronic effect, acute and chronic effects on all kinds of aquatic organisms. It's one of the things that's as you, I'm sure the caller knows this, but atrazine is one of the number one groundwater contaminants in the United States. It's even been found in groundwater in Lihue, in the drinking water, in years past.
Yeah, but one of the problems we're finding, Don, is in trying to get a handle on this, the company is always chant the statement that the label's the law, but that's based on individual testing, and with time and gathering more knowledge, you find out that the toxic doses are divide the safe presumed dose divided by 10 to the 6, 10 to the 8, and there's significant toxicity.
Well, that's also been shown with things like glyphosate and Roundup, because the EPA and other licensing agencies believe that glyphosate was the active ingredient, they only studied the toxicity of it. When they're actually finding out that the adjuvant, the surfactant that helps get the glyphosate into the tissue of plants, it's called POE-15, is actually more toxic to organisms than the glyphosate is. So we were testing the wrong compound or fraction of the compound. So you're right. It's a whole new world. You know, if Rachel Carson was alive today, I think she would be writing a new book.
But thank you for bringing that up, caller, and thank you for doing your work.
You're welcome.
Aloha.
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 And just for his benefit, some of the things that Greta Abey plans to look for in tissue analysis on some of these corals would be compounds like atrazine because it's so
readily
available.
And I'd like to contrast atrazine with some of these other compounds because atrazine is not one that
not persistent.
Well, and not one that you would expect to have as natural background levels in our sediment coming down from the Malka areas. So any presence of atrazine would indicate, that might be a stressor in our environment.
Well,
is that right, Carl?
Well, I think that's right. This is not a natural occurring compound.
Right.
It had to come from some agricultural use sometime in the past 20 years or more. But one of the things I would really like to know is what are the concentrations on the reefs? Because we have an idea of the how much water is coming down, and if we mix that all up, we have look at the mixing rates. And so there's a big difference between what you find in a stream or a river and what actually is in the ocean.
Makes it out
well,
to
let's
reefs.
Let's yeah. also and clarify that some of these pesticides are not used by agriculture. The dieldrin only showed up in urban streams on Oahu. When they tested agriculture streams and remote streams, they couldn't find any.
Yeah, it's not just agriculture.
It's not just agriculture. It's like Carl said, people use this stuff in their backyard.
So we've got another caller.
Caller, go ahead, please.
Go ahead, caller.
I hate to kind of change the subject. Not changing the subject, but not to belittle this important topic that you're talking of, but just generally, the tendency of a high island to become an atoll is a natural process. And I have to think that God made man to slow down that process. And he scattered the rocks all over the land that need to be assembled in soil-retaining walls that can accomplish that, where you can actually build an island instead of just sit on it and watch it get smaller and smaller underneath of you. And I know the Hawaiians were well aware of this, of master stone builders, am I coming through?
Yes, you are. You're absolutely right. All the traditional taro fields were rock building, sediment trapping. They were constructed wetlands that trapped that soil and kept it on land.
Mm.
You're absolutely right.
And as the population grows, the island grows. It's such a phenomenon. You know, it's just...
That's right. Pu'upo'a Marsh is a good example of that. It used to be part of the ocean, and a fish pond was built there, and then no one took care of it, and it all filled up with mud.
So, with complete respect to our Tongan brothers, I noticed, you know, they came here after Eva and Iniki, and generally, to a man, they're rock wall builders and tree trimmers, because these are the two tools that we have at our disposal to save the island. To save the island.
You know, I think this is Bill, I think.
Yeah.
Aloha, Bill. You know, we had a previous speaker on here, Dr. Terry Work, and we all agreed that one of the things our island is suffering from is kidney failure. We've lost our wetlands. We've lost our taro fields that catch not only the terrigenous sediments, the mud, but it also catches woody debris and all kinds of organic leaf litter that and keeps it on the land. So your point's well taken.
One other thing here, Bill, is that we, with global climate change, we're seeing sea level rise, and they're now maybe 6 feet by the end of the century. So if we're going to keep from moving way back into the ocean, we're going to have to stop the movement of the water back. We're going to have more rock walls somewhere.
And taro fields.
And taro fields. We're going to have to look at the whole... retention of that soil the land.
Yeah, and I think the real demonstration that the massive landscape level changes in the environments wrought by the Hawaiians was sustainable because in doing so the reefs were healthy enough to support over 1 million people.
So speaks for itself.
It speaks for itself. Yeah. So thank you for bringing that up.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay. To close the point, I think it wouldn't be too presumptuous to make a moratorium on the building of frivolous walls, that these rocks are more valuable than just to make ornamental walls that, you know,
each rock has its right place, and that's where it should go. Yeah, thank you.
Now they're becoming so valuable, you can't use them for farming, for actual retaining purposes. They're just for ornamentals.
Yeah.
That's right.
Kind of like coconut trees.
All right.
I have to get that in.
Yeah, thank you, brother.
That was Coconut
okay,
Bill. Thanks,
right.
Bill.
Aloha.
Do we have another? I think we have another caller.
Aloha, gentlemen.
Aloha.
Dr. Carl, Don, and Adam. Two questions. Number one, does your purview include the monitoring of any kind of radiation, like from Fukushima?
Personally, I don't. I do it by looking at the radiation that's on the beaches in the marine debris and the rocks and things on the beaches. But I am close friends with Dr. Henrietta Delovia, who spoke at our Fukushima conference 2 years ago, and who I actually spoke today with concerning our next conference coming up mid-March. And she told me that she didn't answer the phone because she was reading off the results of today's tests for cesium-134 in the ocean. I can pass on to you that in looking for specifically cesium-134, which is the tracer of the Fukushima nuclear accident, there has yet to been found any 134 in the waters of Hawaii. In
cesium?
Cesium-134.
As I understand, when they've been monitoring the tuna in California that supposedly have swum from Japan, there's a tremendous amount of cesium.
It's the same stuff, right?
Yeah.
But the difference is that they picked it up as little fish over there and incorporated it in their bodies when they're over there, and then they swam across the ocean to California.
Right.
And so that cesium radiation, that chemical that they picked up, that isotope, is in their bodies, and it will stay there for a while. But that has not floated in the water column across to Hawaii.
They didn't pick up that cesium in the California environment.
That's right. They didn't pick it up in the California environment. They picked it up in the Japanese environment.
Yep.
And then they transited it.
That's because they're oceanic tunas.
Yeah.
Well, let me get something straight with you. I understand your comments. Are you suggesting that if we return to the methodology of our Hawaiian brethren of old, their ecologically correct methodologies, that this would perhaps serve as natural chelators to our really acidic environment?
No.
No, we're not saying that whatsoever.
No.
So would it affect the acidity if we return to the Hawaiian methods?
No, because I think if you look at the acidity of what's going on in natural Hawaiian taro fields, they put a lot of plant material in there to fertilize it. It's organic rebuilding.
Yeah.
And that would add acidity to the waters also.
I see. So then on the last comment, how receptive do you think these big corporate developers of golf courses and mega projects would be to a less stressful, non-pesticide, herbicide methodology for grooming their grounds?
Well, that's a cultural issue.
Yeah.
If we went to Scotland where they invented golf,
right,
they still play on the rough. They don't use pesticides. We're the only ones with these laser flat greens that use more pesticides than any form of agriculture known on planet Earth, except for maybe some of the biotech industries.
And didn't the folks in the Great Britain use kelp as a soil additive?
It's great for here because our soils are low in selenium, and kelp is seaweed. Limu is high in selenium.
Well, thank you so much for this really great program.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So, 45 minutes into our program, and I want to get to the punchline.
Yeah, let's get to the punchline.
It's been really good because these calls have helped us identify natural and historic events and contributions from the land to the ocean that didn't cause and do not cause the type of stressors that we're seeing now. Okay, and so we want to continue that discussion because Carl has provided me here in the studio. I've got this list of compounds, I mean, these are like chemicals, right, that the Department of Health says when they sample the soils in Hanalei Bay, they can find them there. And when I look at this list, there's something like arsenic. So, Carl, you're telling me, I mean, arsenic is a poison, right? Chromium, lead. If our kids eat lead paint, you know, it's gonna cause brain damage. So, why is the Department of Health saying that these compounds are acceptable in the sediments in our waters?
The main reason, and I'm reading here from the Department of Health thing, is that these metals in soils are tightly bound up to the iron hydroxide, the rust, the iron, and other complexes, and do not pose a public health risk or an environmental risk because they do not, they're bound. They don't go into the water, and they then are not biologically available. They're not taken up by the animals that are in the water, whether that's a human or otherwise. So these things are bound. Let me give an example. There is a lot of chromium. We say there's chromium in here. Well, we need chromium. It's in my vitamin pills and stuff like that. But chrome, anything you see bright and shiny is chrome. And that's your regulator and your diving gear. That's the your stainless steel tank is chrome and iron. And so all of these things have chromium in them, but it's not leaching out into the water, and it's not biologically available to you. Nickel is another one that is a toxic in some forms, but that's our coins, and it's not leached out into the air or into our sweat. So a lot of these things just... they're bound up into their metal phase. Now, the right word, these are metals. They're all elements. There are basic That's elements right. in the periodic chart, if you remember from chemistry. But they all form complexes with other chemicals, and those complexes are what makes them available to dissolve in water or available to take up by tissues, etc. The big part here, taking it to corals, is that the muds themselves smother the corals, and they're probably not taking up these metals. So, for example, if you wanted to kill a coral, you could put a plastic bag over it, and it wouldn't be the chemicals from the plastic that killed it. It would be the smothering effect.
Lack of oxygen.
Lack of oxygen and everything else. So muds are definitely deadly, but I wouldn't call them toxic because meaning to it. It's a chemical that you're taking up, a toxic effect. So muds are deadly. Muds in the Hanalei River are deadly and are not good for the coral reefs. Muds in the Hanalei River are not toxic. And so we shouldn't use that word misappropriately.
I think if I can, to clarify this a little bit. Mud's been washing down the Hanalei River for probably 5 million years or maybe four. When we look at metals, elements, we have to have iron in our diet or our hemoglobin won't function. Invertebrates, like lobsters and others, I don't know where my cup, have to have copper because they have hemocyanin, not hemoglobin. So lobster needs copper in its diet. But in the case of, this goes back a few decades, but a big nuclear power plant in Monterey, California, called Diablo Canyon, had a problem, and they shut down for 3 or 4 days while they fixed the problem. I'm not sure what it was, a cooling problem. Well, they had all copper pipes in the whole facility. So that salt water set in the copper pipe for 3 or 4 days. Then they turned it back on and dumped all that elemental copper out into that dissolved copper into the ocean, and they lost hundreds of thousands of invertebrates. It killed them all. It was too high a dose of copper.
Okay, so it seems like we've identified a couple different specific issues with regard to these things that are coming from our Mauka regions and being deposited in the marine environment. There are things like the atrazine that the caller talked about that they've identified in the water.
That ain't coming down the watershed
right,
from
so that, Mount Waialae. Yeah, that didn't originate from Mount Waialae.
Neither did Dieldrin.
Neither did Dieldrin. Okay, so that that the mere presence of that indicates there's something going on in our lower regions, and that in and of itself, the presence, could be a stressor in the marine environment if it makes it out there, as Carl pointed out. We don't know if it gets out to the reef, but if it does, it could be a stressor. Okay. Now, when I look at, and then we talked about tons and tons of mud that originated in the mountain and that flows out annually down the river into Hanalei Bay. The mud itself can be a stressor if it were deposited on the reef, it was at Pilau.
Yes, because that was unnatural.
That was unnatural. Within that mud, there are certain compounds, elements like arsenic, chromium, nickel, lead, things that can be toxic, but aren't necessarily toxic in the forms in which they occur in that mud. Is that correct? So it is the form in which they're in and their association with other elements that makes them toxic or non-toxic. Is that correct?
All right. Basically.
Okay.
And you have to assume that all of these animals, both in the streams and in the ocean, have evolved and are adapted
to certain levels,
ambient, natural levels of those elements.
Okay, well, actually, that's the third thing. So we can actually have compounds that may actually be fairly high, but the form in which they're in,
that's right,
are non-toxic. Now we can have other forms of, let's say, the chromium that Carl pointed out, that at certain levels we actually require it, right? But at higher levels it then becomes toxic. So it's very, when we begin to try to identify these stressors, it becomes very, very complicated, and we have to understand exactly the sources of these, the forms that they're in, and finally, their concentrations. Is that right? Because all those can play a role in determining whether or not they actually may be impacting the reef.
And I think if we're trying to understand what is the stress level on the reefs, we have to start measuring the water and physical properties on the reef, which is why I have automatic computer data sensors on the reef itself. Not for these metals, not for chemicals, but because we find it or don't find it in the Hanalei River or any of our rivers or in the mud, that doesn't tell us anything about what's on the reef. So if we want to know what the stressors are on the reef, we have to sample the water on the reef, and because it changes every millisecond with the currents and the input, we have to do that a lot. We have to look at all the waters. But the other way of looking at it is to start looking at the tissues of the animals on the reef, like I did the animals in the river, but start looking at the tissues to see what did they take up, because they will only have taken it up if it's out there. If we find these things in there, we go, ah. And this is part of the type of work that Dr. Bob Richmond at the University of Hawaii does. He has all sorts of biomarkers to be able to look at the uptake of the chemicals and soil and stuff in the genome of these animals. And so it's at a much more sophisticated level. But this initial screening work, if we find, for example, that there's no pesticides coming down the rivers and streams in Hanalei, then we can say, well, that is not going to be one of the stressors, except for atrazine, as this gentleman called in. Those are not the stressors. But what are the stressors out there? And we got to wind up.
Yeah. So I guess the message is stay tuned. This is an important issue. We're very fortunate. We've got kahuna like Dr. Carl Berg here on island working with other experts from around the world to help us begin to puzzle out this problem so that we can help improve our environment for future generations. But it is complicated. Everybody should educate themselves and stay on top of this as it goes forward. But let's do that. Let's stay educated on the issue and try to understand our environment. Thank you so much for joining us,
Thanks for coming, Carl.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Aloha.